From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
Fillmore.
I'm from San Jose.
I'm from the Intermission.
UCCC World.
West Oakland.
East Oakland.
Coming up, we hear how a gay Syrian refugee made his way to the Bay Area.
If you're not safe outside and you're not safe inside, you better run. Nobody's going to save you.
Then I talk with a UC Berkeley economist who says there's a connection between rising temperatures and rising global violence.
These long-term warming and drying trends are associated with the collapse of several major human civilizations.
And how two people with physical disabilities met and started an acclaimed dance company.
Okay, were people giving us a standing ovation because what they saw was really great? Or was it because, oh, look at those brave people up there?
Pushing past boundaries, today on Cross Currents. There are now more displaced people around the world than at any time since the end of World War II. Here in the Bay Area, some local groups are creating a haven for one population of refugees, people who have fled persecution because of their sexual orientation. One of those refugees is Subhi Nahas, a gay man who made the journey from Syria to the Bay Area. KALW's Eli Wertschafter brings us his story.
Subhi Nahas remembers the exact day when he knew he'd have to leave Syria. It was the spring of 2012. He was 24, on a bus going to university to take a final exam, the last exam he needed to graduate. He says they came up to a checkpoint and a group of soldiers stopped the bus. They checked the IDs of all the young men, and then they singled out Subhi.
They take you to our room and put you in a chair where you're all alone.
These were Syrian government soldiers. They were cracking down on rebels who opposed the president, Bashar al-Assad.
The chairs and the table and the ground, they're full of blood.
Subhi had nothing to do with the civil war. But these soldiers decided to pick on him anyway. They'd noticed that he looked different, kind of effeminate. They started mocking him.
They were picking up on me especially because of, you know, look at the way he walks, look at his, you know, dress, look at his hair.
He said for 30 minutes they harassed him and called him homophobic names. He was scared for his life.
And that moment I was like feeling that, yeah, that's the end of it.
It wasn't. They let him go without hurting him. But after that, Subhi was too afraid to go back to school.
When I came back home, I was saying to myself, so what's the point of staying in Syria while you cannot complete your studies, and without this, like, you cannot do anything.
The soldiers who messed with Subhi were from the Assad regime. But a few months later, rebels who opposed Assad took root in Subi's city. They belonged to Al-Nusra Front, which is the Syrian branch of Al-Qaeda. For Subhi, they were even worse than the regime. They announced that they would, quote, cleanse the city of sodomites.
So I cannot go to university, I cannot go out, so I have to stay home all the time. But then, staying at home was not safe too.
Like a lot of LGBT people who become refugees, Subhi felt threatened by his own family. His parents never accepted the idea of a gay son. Subhi lived at home with them, but his father didn't speak to him.
We sometimes don't even say good morning to each other, so even when we speak, he never expressed his emotions or feelings and how he does feel about it, except when he's really angry and he wants to express how angry he is.
One day they were in the kitchen. They had a fight and his father lost his temper.
He grabbed my head from the back and he just smashed it into the kitchen counter.
Subhi still has a scar on his chin.
If you're not safe outside and you're not safe inside, and your family will not protect you from your father because your father have anger management issues, so you better run. Nobody's going to save you.
He immediately made plans to cross the border into Lebanon, where he had a friend he could stay with. This journey was legal, but he had heard horrible stories about gay people who were raped as they tried to get across. So he bribed a taxi driver to deal with all the checkpoints. Subhi sat in the back of the cab and pretended he couldn't talk. He stayed in Lebanon for 6 months. And then he moved to Turkey, where it was a little easier to be gay.
It was a different completely different experience, especially exploring myself, exploring my sexuality, trying to understand my body more.
But still, he knew he couldn't stay there. Turkey doesn't let any Syrian refugees become citizens. And so he had two options. He could travel to a country like Germany and hope they gave him asylum, or he could apply to the UN, which can resettle refugees to another country. In Turkey, he met a lawyer from a group called ORAM, the Organization for Refuge and Migration. They're based in San Francisco, and they advocate for LGBT refugees around the world. They explained to Subi how the UN program works.
ORAM helped me to understand these interviews and helped me to understand the procedures and what they do and how long it takes.
The UN only resettles people who are part of a persecuted group. One of those groups is LGBT people. But there are 4.5 million Syrian refugees, and less than 1% of them make it through the UN's process.
I never knew that my case would be, like, really accepted.
The process took almost a year. Subi did interview after interview, screening after screening, until one day he found out that he was cleared. Subi flew to California on June 4th, 2015. He even knew who he was going to live with. An older gay couple in Oakland had agreed to be his sponsors, to host him in their home.
Yeah, well, that is good. Yeah. Very good idea.
Subi is back in the house of his sponsor, Fred Hertz. He lived here for his first 2 months. Subi's slicing off the crown of a dark red pomegranate.
Oh, that's really good. You don't cut it all the way through.
No, because it's easy. Right.
When he lived here, he and Fred got really into cooking together. The pomegranate is going on a roasted eggplant dish, which Subi calls mlatash.
Say it again.
Mlatash.
Mlatash. M-L.
Fred got involved with LGBT refugee rights 5 years ago.
Here I am, this successful gay lawyer who is, you know, living a very liberated life with a long-term partner. And when someone comes forward and says, there are these gay people who are in trouble in other countries, you know, how can I say no?
But taking a refugee into his own home, that was another level.
I would say my biggest worries were things like, oh my God, what if he gets here and has a nervous breakdown and, like, locks himself in the room and doesn't come out for 6 months? What am I going to do?
But they got along like family. Subi felt the same way.
They even became vegetarian for a whole month. It was like, I'm vegetarian, so it's like they did not bring meat to the house. That was something I really, really appreciate.
Subi showed me his old room in Fred's house.
And yeah, I used to store stuff in that box. Lots of stuff, especially paperwork, because, you know, in the States, they send everything, like, lots of paper.
His visa, medical exam paperwork, bank documents, his vaccination card. He spent most of his first month here getting all his papers in order.
It's time-consuming, and I think without Fred and his partner, I would have not done it in 1 month, and that I would still, until now, stuck doing all the paperwork.
This was actually part of Fred's commitment as a sponsor. He had a list of all the appointments Subi needed to get to. And when Fred wasn't available, he got his friends to help too. Especially for LGBT refugees, creating that kind of community is essential.
Let's say if you're not an LGBT, you'll be expected to be resettled with your own community. But if you're an LGBT, most of the time you're escaping from your own community, or you're escaping from your family, or you have nobody. So you need somebody to be with you, and you need somebody to help you in the first steps.
Subi has had an amazingly smooth transition into the United States. Some help came from the government. When they first arrive, refugees get a small stipend and they can apply for food stamps and health care. And like almost everybody in the refugee program, Subi's on track to eventually get a green card and U.S. citizenship. But what sets his case apart is the bond he made with Fred and the local gay community. Now, Subi is working at ORAM, the same organization he reached out to when he was in Turkey. Subi knows how rare his case is, so he's working to help other refugees make it to the other side. Subi shows me a poster that he designed with ORAM. It says the words, "You are safe here," in a dozen languages, in rainbow colors. They're sending it to refugee offices around the world.
You step into the office and you look to the wall and you see this, and you see the rainbow, then you will know that you're safe here, even if you're an LGBT.
Subi has lots of friends who are visiting offices like these in Turkey and Lebanon, waiting for resettlement. But recently, one of Subi's friends also made it through. His name is Nader Türkmani. Subi called him up on Skype after he heard the news. Nader is also gay and Syrian. He petitioned the UN for years. Now he'll be able to move from Turkey to Norway.
Hi.
Subi and Nader started an LGBT support group in Istanbul. Since Subi moved, he's been helping Nader manage the group long distance. Now they're making plans for when Nader will leave too.
Hopefully our group will be there for a long time.
Groups like the one Subi started, or people like Fred and his partner, they give LGBT refugees something they're usually missing, a family that looks out for them.
It's a good feeling when you really know that somebody cares and loves you this much. It's life-changing.
In San Francisco for Cross Currents, I'm Eli Werchafter.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. Some scientists say that you can't talk about the global refugee crisis without talking about another crisis, climate change. Edward Miguel is an economics researcher at UC Berkeley who warns that as the planet heats up, we'll be seeing more wars and more mass migration. He visited KELW to tell me the bad news in person. We just heard a story about a refugee from Syria. And I was wondering, you've done a lot of research on the link between climate change and war, climate change and violence, climate change. What is the link now between possibly climate change and refugees, people forced to leave their homes at this time?
Yeah, there's really a growing body of evidence that extreme climate disrupts the economy in many different ways. In poor societies where people rely on agriculture, when the rains fail or there's extreme drought, extreme temperature, and they can't farm their land, they're very often displaced. They move to cities. They go somewhere where they can earn a living when their crops fail. So years of extreme climate are also very often years of displacement. And you mentioned Syria. There's research that's come out recently documenting that in the run-up to the start of the civil war in Syria in 2011, actually the 3 years before the civil war, were the 3 years of most extreme drought in recorded history in Syria. And so during that period of 2008 to 2011, something like half of the livestock in Syria died. Hundreds of thousands of farmers couldn't make a living on their land. And of course, there are many factors that have contributed to the war in Syria, but this economic shock of extreme drought could have played a role in precipitating some of the violence. When people are poor and desperate and hungry, it may be easier to recruit them into militias or insurgency groups, and they're a displaced population with nowhere to go.
And so what about global warming? What relationship would that have to unrest?
So we've looked at this relationship with co-authors, with my co-author Solomon Shang and Marshall Burke here at Berkeley and at Stanford, and found a very strong link between extreme temperature and violence of many different forms. So civil wars are more likely to break out in sub-Saharan Africa following a very hot year. And again, the economic channel and the fact that at very high temperatures, crops don't do well and the economy is disrupted is probably part of the story, but it's much broader than that.
Is it mostly about the crops, the heat in relation to crops, or other things as well?
Yeah, so the evidence that's coming out recently suggests it goes beyond agriculture. So if we look at the effect of extreme climate and extreme temperatures on the economy, agriculture suffers when there's extreme climate. Most people would expect that because, you know, crops are sensitive to climate. Mm-hmm. But even non-agricultural economic activity is very sensitive to temperature. So, Indian factory workers' productivity, it's been shown, falls when temperatures are high. In the U.S., people have looked at the labor productivity of people who work outside, of manual labor. It falls when temperatures are higher. So there's an agricultural channel and a non-agricultural channel, and both of those contribute to worse economic conditions when it gets hot.
So you looked at the relationship between temperature and violence, and we talked about that. How did you do that study? How did you conduct it?
So this was a really great learning experience for me. We decided to go beyond our own research with my co-authors, with Solomon Chang and Marshall Burke. We had all worked on this issue separately on different projects. I'd been working on civil war in Africa. Saul had been working on El Nino, actually a very relevant thing for our California audience. Saul showed that the global El Nino cycle, which leads to warming in some parts of the world in some years and cooling in others, actually explains a lot of the onset of new civil wars in poor parts of the world. Mm. So in those hot El Nino years, we get a lot of rain here, but in other parts of the world, they're very dry and hot. It really depends on where you are. In those very hot El Nino years, you see spikes in civil conflict. It can explain something like a quarter of new civil conflicts in the world over the last few decades. So we'd each been doing our own thing, but we wanted a more systematic answer. So we dug around for all the research we could find, published or unpublished, from economics, political science, history, psychology, like these psychology lab studies I was talking about before. And archaeologists have actually found that in the long run, these long-term warming and drying trends are associated with the collapse of several major human civilizations. So a major empire in the Middle East, the Akkadian Empire, collapsed following a major drought. The Maya Empire here, you know, in the Americas, in Mexico, collapsed after a century with three mega droughts, like unprecedented, historically unprecedented droughts. Angkor Wat in Cambodia collapsed following a huge drought, et cetera. So there's this historical body of evidence, and we put it all together. There were 60 studies, quantitative studies with data. And they paint this remarkably consistent picture. Almost all of them have this finding that high temperatures lead to more violence.
And what about violence on a personal level?
So if we look at the US, if there's a hot week or a hot month in a particular city, crime rates rise. There's sort of conventional wisdom in the US that that may be the case. If you've seen, you know, Do the Right Thing, you know, the hottest night of the summer, things got overheated. Mm-hmm. People lost their head. But that's a systematic pattern. If there's a hot month in a U.S. city, an exceptionally hot month, there's more murder, there's more assault, et cetera. So
and
those
why?
Are channels. Yeah, those are channels that can't really be economic.
Right.
Like day to day, month to month, it isn't like it's a little hot in the city. Our incomes are gonna fall. So that's where psychological or physiological channels have to be important. This is a problem that may not have a simple solution because there's an economic channel, there's a psychological channel. And these things could reinforce each other.
Mm-hmm. And so what are you hoping will happen next with this body of research?
First of all, we want to be heard so that the evidence is out there and policymakers understand the implications of continued warming. So if the research can nudge policymakers, push them even a little bit in the direction of more renewable energy, fewer CO2 emissions, that's something we would really want to happen. So I think we have a long way to go. And again, the fear is our projections on the link between climate and violence go out to about 2050. And
that's it.
We're going to keep warming. Yeah. I mean, over that, you know, multi-decadal scale, we're going to keep warming. So we've got to learn how to deal with it and adapt to it, even though the best solution would be to not warm in the first place. So I think, you know, both on the mitigation front, the reduction of emissions, and the adaptation front, I think the research can inform policy. And my dream would be that it gives policymakers more of a will to change, that it pushes them in a direction and really forces them to look into the abyss here about where we're going if we warm by 3 or 4 or more degrees Celsius, which is possible. That would be a very different world than the world we live in today.
Edward Miguel is an economist at UC Berkeley and director of the Center for Effective Global Action. Listening to Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba. 28 years ago, Bonnie Lukowitz got a phone call from someone wanting to know what she thought about the idea of disabled people dancing. That question set her on an improbable odyssey. She sat down with her longtime friend and collaborator Judith Smith to tell the story of Oakland-based Axis Dance Company, which is internationally renowned for integrating disabled and able-bodied dancers.
I think our lives would have, our paths would have crossed regardless of whether we had come together on that one fateful day where we both showed up for, well, I didn't really know what I was showing up for other than to explore dancing with people. And that in and of itself wouldn't be that unusual for people to come together to dance, but because we both use wheelchairs, it was not something I thought would be happening. Wow, what a journey it's been.
It has been, but I think it was more unusual for me because you at least had a dance background. I grew up in Colorado, and I thought I was going to spend my life showing jumping horses. And I was injured in a car accident when I was 17. And I found my way to Berkeley, California, and started exploring all sorts of different things, including martial arts, which is what led me to Axis, A-X-I-S, Dance Company.
So I studied dance for many years, 10 years, and then I also, as you know, broke my neck in a dune buggy accident and thought dance was never going to be a part of my life, even though it was still a big part of who I was. And when I got that phone call that one day, unbeknownst to the person on the other end of the call, asking me if I wanted to come check out this group of people getting together to explore how people with and without disabilities could dance, my first thought was, well, they can't. But it intrigued me, and so I thought, well, let's check this out. And, I mean, I was hooked immediately. You know, we've talked about this, you know, in the beginning years was, okay, were people giving us a standing ovation because what they saw was really great? Or was it because, oh, look at those brave people up there. I could never get up on stage and do that if I looked like them. And I think we decided that it was we were creating good art. And I think that was always the focus of Axis. It was never to go out and make any kind of statement, political statement, but just the fact of who we were, what our makeup was, people with and without disabilities, it made a statement. Without hammering it over people's heads.
Bonnie Lukowitz and Judith Smith are the founders of Axis Dance Company. They're touring all around the country this year. Find the information at kalw.org and click on Cross Currents. And if you've got a story about pushing boundaries, we'd love to hear it. Email us at news@kalw.org or call us and leave a message on our feedback line. The number is 415-264-7106. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Luisa Cardoza, Lila Day, Audrey Dilling, Nina Gensler-Debs, Angela Johnston, Casey Miner, Ted Muldoon, James Rowland, Stephen Short, and Eli Wirtschafter. Today's show was engineered by Chris Hoff. The line producer was Liza Veal. Our managing editor is Jen Sheehan. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. This music is by the family Crest, who went from busking at farmers markets to playing an NPR Tiny Desk concert in just the last couple of years. They play the Great American Music Hall tonight, and the show starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.